I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
And good morning and welcome to this July 11th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'll remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this station are those exclusively of the radio, not KUCI, the UC Board of Management, or the UC Board of Regents. Having a few computer little glitches this morning, no big deal, but you get to hear my disclaimer out loud. So we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. I'm joined now by Gabriel Hook, and coming up in the second half, Kylie Wolfson-Widger will be joining me to chat about her novel, Mother of Invention. Gabriel is originally from New Orleans, where his family still lives and in which many of the stories in You or a Loved One are set. He holds an MFA from the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program and a PhD in creative writing from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he is currently a lecturer in the English department. His story, When the Time Came, was selected as a distinguished story in the 2015 edition of Best American Short Stories, edited by T.C. Boyle. Other stories have appeared in Glimmer Train, The Sewanee Review, Mid-American Review, Western Humanities, a ton of other journals. The collection is You or a Loved One. It's published by Orison Books. Gabe, welcome.
Hey. Hey. How are you doing, Marie?
Am I saying Orison, but is that how I'm... Am I pronouncing it right? I was trying to figure
out. Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, I think it's Orison Books. That's how I've heard them say it, so that's what I've said. Although my last name is pronounced Houck.
That was my follow-up question. I was like, you know what? I feel like I've been saying your name. So we've known each other for a couple of years, and I feel like I've been saying your name wrong. I say my own name wrong.
It's terrible to start an interview with, like, a correction on how you pronounce my name.
That is super important. That is super. And everybody mispronounces my name, so I'm super sensitive to that. So I'm glad after years of knowing each other, we've got that.
Yeah, on air, no less.
Yeah, right. So, you know what? Before I knew you, I didn't even know you could get a PhD in creative writing. I think that is so cool. Tell me a little bit about what kind of the distinguishing degrees. I know a lot of people and a lot of our listeners have MFAs, but I thought if you could just kind of introduce yourself by talking a little bit about kind of that journey into creative writing
sure.
and that decision to get both those degrees and kind of what each one does for you.
Sure. I think in hindsight, it all looks very, like, sort of mechanical and planned out. But honestly, like, you know, mostly it was dictated by my life and being lazy and making poor decisions and then realizing I had to do something else in order to keep the train moving. So that's, like, the disclaimer to start is that, like, you know, my path was just my path on this. But PhDs in creative writing, as far as I understand them, I applied in 2010, 2011, and it seemed like they were just discovering what they were. Every program I got into and visited was, like, wildly different from another one. Some of them were very sort of English-heavy. They were basically an English PhD with a creative dissertation.
Okay.
Some of them looked a lot like an MFA that spread over 5 years. Some of them were condensed into 3 years, and there was no opportunity to have what's called ABD, which is the sort of all the dissertation period of your PhD where you're just working on your creative work.
Okay.
So it was really kind of all over the place, and it didn't seem like anyone knew what it was. I'm not sure anyone really still does, because when I'm on the job market and I interview at universities, I get the question a lot, what is a creative writing PhD? And I sort of get embarrassed because, you know, we're all sort of academic professionals sort of wondering what our credentials actually mean. I mean, the best way I could describe Nebraska's experience and my experience here with it was, and the reason I chose Nebraska was it felt a lot like an MFA. There was a lot of workshop focus. The professionalizing was obviously a big part of it. And just as a side, I think that's what PhDs generally do to distinguish themselves from MFAs. It's teacher training, and it's pedagogy, and it's professionalizing. It's that stuff layered over your traditional 2 or 3 year workshop experience that you would get in an MFA. But you're surrounded by fantastic writers, a lot of sort of hands-off, especially in Nebraska, a lot of hands-off academic environment, and a really supportive group of faculty who want you to do innovative things. And I came here, by the way, just as another sort of side, I came here doing nonfiction. As you mentioned in the intro, I did an MFA in nonfiction at Iowa and had every intention of writing a nonfiction book when I arrived here. And Nebraska, like, sort of gave me the latitude to switch and slide and, you know, change skins in that way. So when I started writing the stories for You, a Loved One, it was okay to switch my dissertation and make that the project that I really focused on, and ultimately make fiction and the sort of between space of genre the thing that I focused on. So, but in terms of the state of affairs of, like, creative writing PhDs generally, I can only speak for what I've encountered, but my sense of it is that it's still as sort of diverse and wild westy as it was 8 or 9 years ago, just that there's more of them now. And yeah, so it follows the trend of proliferation of, like, MFAs, too, in that way.
Yeah, that's really cool. That was going to be my next question, is if you or a loved one emerged out of that program. So it sounds like that was your dissertation that you worked on while you were there.
It was, and it was, like I said, it was sort of plan B. 2 or 3 years in, I had built a committee around a different nonfiction project and sort of come to a standstill on it. And it was just when I had started publishing short stories and finding sort of a foothold in that. And I've told this story in different ways before, but I think, like, the switch was so fortuitous and never something I could have planned. Like, I, you know, had I gone to a program that had, and this is no slight against Nebraska, but had I gone to a program that had a more robust nonfiction presence in the faculty or a more sort of a fully dedicated nonfiction track for its PhD, because we didn't really have that here. It was not something that was well built up. But if we had, I never would have made this move. And that was good for me, the move, in a way, because I think what I was running out of space for in nonfiction was a way to talk about my life meaningfully without putting myself on the stage each time I wrote an essay. And fiction has been this wonderful sort of sleight of hand where I am unbound from the rules of representation that nonfiction throws to me, but I'm still capable and really, like, encouraged to write all the authenticity of what I know and remember and experience growing up, say, in New Orleans or in the various other parts of my life. And I can reprocess all that authenticity in a way that doesn't have to be bound to the truth. I think I'm speaking more vaguely than I mean, but fiction was a real eye-opener for me. And, like, that transition from nonfiction to fiction really, like, invigorated all these kind of dead stories that I didn't know what to do with an essay, because ultimately it was just a man talking about himself. And that seemed, I don't know, that seemed very limited to me. I had run out of space for that.
We do talk about that a lot on this show, the things fiction can do and the truths it can get to that nonfiction really can't. When you're bound by a strict fact, it really is a very limiting experience. And I think, fiction allows so much latitude and ability to dig into things in a way that is way more fun.
the title story of the collection, You Are a Loved One, is a great example of this. And this is actually maybe the second time I've spoken publicly about this, because I mentioned this at a talk I gave at the University of Louisiana this spring. That story is very unpopular with my family. I don't know if you've read it. It's the title story of the collection. But if you have read it, you'll recognize, and if you know anything about my family, you'll recognize that it's very close to a portrait of my own family. The difference is mainly that the narrator is a 40-something-year-old woman and not me, Gabe Houck. But the brother and the family and the dynamics of that family are very, very true to my experience. And I think what was so, like, difficult about that story was also what made it work so well, like the sort of the creeping darkness that makes you doubt whether or not you should write something is often, as you know, I think, like, sort of radioactive material that drives it. The more uncomfortable you feel writing it, the more you probably should write it. But with that, you know, I wrote a story that I think my family is very uncomfortable with for the way that it represents how they relate to my brother, who is a high-functioning autistic man older than me, and who has had his life sheltered by my parents for a very long time, and that's sort of an ongoing point of contention in my family. So now that story is public, but through fiction. And I never could have written it. I tried writing it, an essay, a number of different ways. And I always felt that I had failed to really speak the truth about my family when I was using the quote-unquote truth genre, when I was using essay. And so fiction gave me that latitude to sort of sideways reapproach my family's authenticity in a way that felt so much more real and urgent for the fact that it wasn't me speaking, and I wasn't jumping through all the various hoops of representation that I would have were I to be doing that in essay.
It does seem to me that when we try to approach material in our own lives, there's no way to get at it almost adequately. Like the experience that you live through, you can't say enough about it. And so when you step out of it and make yourself look at it through the prism of somebody else's point of view, you kind of figure out what the important elements are and what the character really needs to do, as opposed to try and throw everything in the kitchen sink in there to explain, the truth of what happened.
Yeah, God, there's a great line in, let's see, it's in Reality Hunger. It's a book by David Shields, and nominally, but actually it's a series of anonymous quotes from other people about genre.
Uh-huh.
And I wish I had it right in front of me right now, because I would read the quote to you. It's so beautiful. And it's about the point you just made. It's about what a naive writer does and a good writer does, both in terms of fiction, where it's the naive fiction writer, and this is sort of paraphrasing, he says, includes everything just because he remembers they happen to be there. And the nonfiction, the savvy fiction writer fashions their contingencies in such a way that only the things that need to be there are there. And that's this great calculus, right? I mean, that's a beyond genre question of writing, is what needs to be there and what doesn't. But I always felt the pressure of too much stuff, too much context, too much explanation, too much exposition in essay. And somehow fiction has freed me from that problem, or at least to some degree it's freed me from it.
Yes. Interesting. I love that. So the book is You or a Loved One, and I would love, enjoy kind of deconstructing a couple of stories and finding out sort of the kernel of how a story began and then some of the artistic decisions that you make along the way to form it, shape it, kind of finding the point of entry, finding the right ending. We've talked a little bit about that one. I don't know if that one makes sense, or if we could just take a couple of these in here, maybe some of the ones that you struggled with the most, and kind of figure out how you did it.
It's great. I'm flattered we would talk about that. So, is there one in particular that you had in mind, or would you like me to?
I love so many of these. I really enjoyed The Confession of Clementine. I really enjoyed...
Oh, wow.
I mean, God, there's so many in here. As I'm flipping through it, I'm like, let's talk about them all, and let's be on the air all day.
I'm doing nothing. That's fine.
They may come in here with a hook with me because they want... But anyway,
sure.
Maybe, if there was one in here that you wrote over a long period of time that kind of, you put away for a while and then you drug it back out and worked on it some more... something that kind of gave you a particular problem so that we can kind of work through those problems with you?
Sure. Let's see. I think it's funny that you mentioned Clementine. That was one of the ones when you asked in your email, by the way, about, ordering a short story collection and how a short story collection comes together. And one of the ways a short story collection came together for me was identifying in my mind the weakest stories and then trying to write better stories so that I could replace the weakest stories with better ones. And I had a sort of a vision in my mind of what I thought the weakest stories were, and I ranked them in order in that way. And, of course, what you think as a writer is not so good. Other people really latch on to you. So I've learned already that that was not a mistake, but clearly just one man's opinion amongst many. Clementine was one of those borderline stories for me, in part because it was my first attempt to write a female lead. I hadn't done that before, and writing outside of your experience while sort of keeping an authentic voice, I think, is one of the great juggling acts, balancing acts of fiction writing. You're sort of taught to do two things at once, right? You have to invent new things, but you also are told to write what you know. And you know that the best lies have all this truth inside of them. So how do you be true and sort of real to what you know in life, but also invent something that's obviously not yourself? The Clementine story came from my parents live in New Orleans, and the house next door was used in a horror movie, which I thought was really weird. Right next door, our neighbor Pam had all of her furniture out at her house one day, just like out on the lawn, and these moving trucks came, and they replaced it with movie furniture that they could murder Hollywood actors on. And it's a nice house. I mean, it's like a pretty house, but I think in the right lighting and context, you could be as scary, but it never struck me as a very spooky house, so I liked the idea of it being given a makeover. So that's really where that story started, was filming a horror movie in a house. And in my mind, Clementine is this woman who had slipped into sort of a life of malaise with her husband, and accidentally her husband had died. She pushed him, he fell down the stairs, she didn't know what to do. And so she buries him in the basement. So there's this kind of noir element of real murder. And then in the movie, she ends up having her house selected to have a horror movie filmed at it as well. So there's this doubling of real and sort of real and simulated murder that goes on in her house. And I liked that as a situation. So many of the stories, and you ask about process, I was thinking about this. Vivian Gornick's book, The Situation and the Story, is a really important book to me, and sort of describing the ways in which we launch into fiction as this process of constructing a meaningful, deep, and interesting situation as a catalyst for story, this kind of petri dish of experience and moment that can launch into a narrative. And that's really where, like, the conscious work of drafting goes for me. It's to try to come up with something like what I just described, a woman who accidentally murders her husband in the same house but later gets filmed for a horror movie. I don't know where the plot is necessarily going to go, and in fact, I've almost never known how stories will end when I write them. And I know that's a cliche that writers say all the time, but it's true. The conscious work is the construction of that conceit and that situation, and the unconscious work is the fun part, which is playing it out and seeing where it goes.
Talk a little bit.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, talk a little bit about finding the right ending, because I think endings to short stories are so very difficult, and I think writers of short stories tend to overwrite the ending several times.
So Christine Scott gave a beautiful talk at Sewanee last year about finding the seeds of endings in beginnings, which. It may be her idea, but it's something I've certainly heard other people speak to as well, where whether you know it or not, when you're starting a story, you are laying a groundwork of themes or ideas or tensions that have an echo at an end. But I think for me, endings can't be plot-driven quite in the way that the endings for a novel might be. The resolution of narrative strands, I mean, I think that's important, but the way that those things resolve are not to surprise us or wrap things up or solve the murder or put us in a parlor and have, you know, Sherlock Holmes explain how it all happened, but more to echo in some interesting and sort of permutated way the ideas that began a story or launched the conflict. But I'll say this, it is always, almost always, an accident when I discover the ending of a story. I remember a couple different times I was writing, What Distant Deeps, Hero Theater, a couple different stories where I'm writing the final paragraph, what ends up being the final paragraph, with the full intention of going on for pages. I had whole other scenes in my mind. And then the language, it's almost like the language is giving you a cue. It's like you hear the exit music at the Oscars and somebody is speaking too long. It's queuing up in the background, and you can feel your own writing starting to sort of crescendo, and there you are. It's arrived. I know this sounds very automatic and probably not very helpful in terms of craft, but I talk about this with my students a lot, and I think we sort of preternaturally understand why something works long before we have the language to describe it. So it's worth following those feelings, those vibes, in writing and kind of testing yourself. Does this have that magic? Does this echo that beginning in a way that feels right? Does this maybe not resolve all the various strands of thought, but does it you know, do enough to twist us and leave us in a good space to ask the right question at the end.
Yes, right. I'm so glad that you said that some of the seeds for the ending are often found in the beginning, because one exercise that I did with your collection was simply to go back and read the first sentence of each story. And
oh, wow.
Your first sentences are stunning.
That's so kind. Thank you.
No, they're just stunning. They're very provocative, and they do lay the foundation and thread. And your voice is so strong. I mean, I feel like now, having read the collection, I will never mistake your voice for another. It's just very distinctive. But so many of these seeds really are in those first sentences. And just the exercise when our listeners pick this collection up, which I really encourage you to do, studying those initial first sentence or two, I think is really a good exercise for writers. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about the point of entry to a story. Sometimes it's just as difficult to get in as it is to get out.
Yeah, totally. My folders on my computer are full of really exciting opening lines that skate off into space and stop. but it doesn't stop me. I actually think that's mostly what my notebook is, too. It's like a bunch of really, like, catchy opening lines. Catchiness is the wrong word here, and that sounds cheaper than what I mean. But one of the things I do also with my fiction students that I get really excited about is a week on establishing voice and opening lines and good opening lines and what they do. And I'm a really big nerd for going through my library and picking, I think, like, really effective first lines. Some of them are very pithy. Some of them are three or four words. Tobias Wolff's story that begins, "Gilbert saw her first." That's the opening line. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't do much other than sort of create this kind of pregnancy of meaning, all this potential to follow the sort of questions laid out by that little phrase. But much more often, I think the opening lines that hook me are the ones that create stakes immediately, that sort of create a voice immediately, and as you were sort of echoing there, that do something that sets ideas into motion, and you get a sense that those ideas aren't going to go away, and that the ending is going to do something with that idea. It's not going to forget it. It's going to move along. So one of my favorite opening lines comes from Donald Ray Pollock. His collection is called Knock 'em Stiff, and it's a series of linked short stories all about a town in Ohio called Knock 'em Stiff, Ohio. And the opening line is the first line of the first story. The story is called Real Life. And the opening line is this: "My father showed me how to hurt a man one August night at the Torch Drive-In when I was 7 years old." That's the line. "My father showed me how to hurt a man one night." I mean, that's just, ugh, it just, and it's beautiful because it ends with the kid licking blood off his knuckles and realizing the wrong lesson from this whole, like, gross thing that happens, a fight at the drive-in theater, where he realizes this is the first time his father has ever been happy with him, is that when he joined the fight unwillingly, and that not just that, but that he wants it and that it feels good to be recognized this way. So it's this really dark and brutal story that broods on the moment of what it means to hurt a man, and it's just this hooky, punchy, good line. I mean, God, every opening line in Donald Ray Pollock's collection is like that.
I was it's
grabbed by the guts, yeah.
No, I was going to say,
sorry,
it's so
ahead.
Funny that you say that, because I feel like that could be one of your opening lines. I mean, I'm now, I'm now, like, flipping through the book saying, okay, if I was to read all of your opening lines, a lot of them would be, you know, during the conversation with the police officer, Chester couldn't take his eyes off the doorway of the shed. And now you're like, oh, boy.
Yeah. Well, establishing, this little curiosity and dread, it feels right.
Yes.
But you actually just said something that made me think of this. I really wanted to say this, and I didn't want to lose the thread before we had to move on, but one of the things you asked in an email about what I think my weaknesses are as a writer, and I think this has to do with one of my weaknesses too, and I mean, of course, I'm one of those writers who thinks my weaknesses are everywhere. Like,
I was
going to
say, did
writing.
I say that?
So, I do, truly, and one of the things that I'm not good at, or that I can't do well, and this, I think, relates to my inability so far to write a novel, is I can't plot out a scene and then write it the straight way. Like, I can't write the events in outline and then write the events in scene. For me, as soon as I look straight at a thing, I can't write it. So one of the alchemy tricks about opening lines and really writing in general for me has always been kind of like an obliqueness. Never writing the exact thing that I want to say, but circumscribing it in a way that suggests that it's there. And maybe sounds a little bit too, I don't know, a little bit too fuzzy for what I'm trying to say, but that line from the beginning of When the Time Came that you just read during the conversation with the police officer, there's always this feeling of medias res with me, like, in writing stuff like that. There's always this feeling that, like, the event has already started without us, that the thing is already happening without us, that the life that you're looking at, you've just kind of accidentally come into in the moment that the story begins. Mm. And that feeling is really pleasant to me. I mean, it sort of gives a veracity and authenticity to the story. But it also flatters what I think I do well and sort of hides what I don't do well, which is I don't know how to write the whole thing. I only know how to sort of angle my way in and suggest the thing that's in the other room. You know, I'm always shading around the elephant, never drawing it.
I feel like that's a strength. You feel like that's a weakness? I mean, I think, well, that is the job of the writer.
I think it's a weakness just because my fear is that this will keep me forever from writing one long, coherent, singular novel, which I do think requires looking at the thing a lot more than what, I mean, I can get away with this in 12 pages, in 15 pages. You know, in short stories, you can get away with all kinds of obliqueness, suggestion, formal constraints. I mean, several of the stories in there are actual flash collections themselves. So, yeah. I mean, I can get away with things, I think, in short story that over the time and sort of attrition of a novel require me to be, I think, a lot more orthodox and a lot more direct. And I'm fully willing to be wrong. I hope I'm wrong because, you know, more than anything, I need to write a novel.
Well, I do.
My agent says so, but yeah.
No, I mean, I do see your point that the muscle of the short story is a very different muscle than of the novel. And, I think internally a lot of writers have kind of a pacing that they're comfortable with. And certainly mine is also for the short story form, too. So, I take your point there. But and, you know, the push for writers to write novels over short stories, I just think is a shame, but that's a whole different radio show. So,
well, agreed. No, it's fair. I share your concern.
It's killing me that we're running out of time, but I would love to also kind of hear some of your other kind of last minute, God, we could talk for hours, but your last minute kind of tricks of the trade of, like, do you keep notebooks or journals of dialogue that you hear? Do you
sure.
kind of write down yeah. interesting sentences that people say, or kind of things that serve
yeah.
you
so,
well?
You know, it's great. I know it's quick, so I'll say this. I teach mostly 19 and 20-year-old students who are really working hard to identify themselves as writers for the first time, don't see very much of themselves in the writing they read in college, especially if it's non-contemporary, if they're reading 19th-century lit. They understand themes of loss and family, but they don't, you know, relate to those lives and those voices in the way that contemporary lit maybe does. So they're all very skeptical the first day of what they're allowed to do. And I hold up a notebook, and I'd say, this is permission. The notebook that you have, and you need, like, 10 notebooks. Like, I have a notebook in my car. I have two in my bag. My phone becomes my notebook when I don't have one near me. The notebook is permission. It's not just a place where you write down great ideas. It's a place where you write down really stupid ideas. It's a place where that idea you had at 4 in the morning seemed amazing, and then when you read it the next day, you laughed at yourself. But you are your only audience, and the act of permission begets more permission. So the more you do it, the more free you feel to do it, and the more free you feel to think and make the kinds of associations that you need to think and make in order, I think, to be a writer. So much of my stories are drawn from this kind of stuff. I go into my notebooks and put little sticky notes on the pages that have lines that have made it into stories. And it's a great sort of happy reminder to look at all these notebooks with overheard conversations and observations and memories and things that my father said once at the breakfast table, and how that all sort of gets atomized into these little details and then reprocessed back into stories. The great stuff of stories, the great realism of them, come from those notebooks, and it is the act of permission to let yourself do it. That's parting advice for all writers, although I think it's the easiest advice in the world, because I don't know a writer without a notebook, but nonetheless.
I love that. I love that. Is there cool. Is there an easy way to stalk you online? Are you
actually,
findable?
No.
I know, you're only not very findable.
Well, okay, a friend of mine, I was just at Vermont Studio Center, and a friend of mine was very kind enough to help me start setting up a website, and it's under construction, and it exists, although it doesn't show up at the top of a Google search, so I'm still working on that. I'm very untech-savvy, but it has to be there, and it'll be there very soon. So soon there will be a website. Otherwise, if you Google me, I think you'll just find my publications, some interviews I've done, my page at the university, and my Facebook page, which proves that I exist and I'm a real person.
you do
but
a
no,
couple.
There's
of...
no great way to stalk me. I apologize.
Yeah, no. I'm so glad there's a website coming because that will be wonderful. And you do have a couple of really wonderful craft videos online that I encourage listeners to look up because you have even more wonderful advice there. And I'm just going to have you back on. If you could finish the next collection super fast so I can have you back on and I can ask you the 30 questions.
Oh, man. I would love to hear. Yeah, if only for that, I will. Thank you, Marie.
Gabriel Houck, this was such a pleasure. You Are a Loved One is the book, and thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. I really do appreciate it.
Okay, hold on a second. That was Gabriel Houck. The book, You Are a Loved One, is out and available now. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will take a very short break and be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. I really encourage you to check us out on iTunes. If you check us out on iTunes under Writers on Writing, you can get all the shows, all the archives. And then as soon as you subscribe, it pops up with the new whatever has been podcast most recently. So I really encourage you to do that. If you're listening live under iTunes, you can find us under College Radio. You can find us on Barbara's website. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows, so check us out there. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Chailey Wilson-Widger is the author of the novel Real Happy Family. Her other work has appeared in numerous literary journals, the New York Times Magazine and Amazon's Day One and on NPR. Her latest is Mother of Invention. It's published by Little A. It is the subject of our chat this morning. Chailey, welcome.
Thank you.
Did I do it right? I feel like am I doing it right? Am I doing the name right?
You got it exactly
super
right,
super self-conscious this morning. So this
is a hard one.
It's a hard one. Everything's hard for me in the morning. I don't know. I loved this book. It was absolutely unputdownable, and I want to talk a little bit about how you made it so unputdownable. But I'm going to let you take us into Mother of Invention for people who haven't yet had the chance to pick it up and kind of introduce us into Tessa's world and kind of the conception of the novel.
Sure. My protagonist, Tessa Callahan, is a Silicon Valley executive and something of a powerhouse. And her latest venture is a suite of products called the Seahorse Solution that essentially eliminates all the inconveniences associated with pregnancy and early motherhood. And the crowning feature of the Seahorse Solution is a biotechnological procedure that reduces pregnancy from the lengthy 40 weeks that it usually takes down to a nice, efficient 9 weeks. And a good part of the book is set in the first human trial of the Seahorse Solution. And there's a cohort of three women who have signed up to try out this fantastic new suite of products and condense their pregnancies. And Tessa is acting as kind of their coach and their supporter. She's with them at this state-of-the-art medical facility as they're undergoing this fairly scary procedure. And because she's been behind the development of it, she helped conceive of it. She's there to really assure them that things are going to be okay. And above all, keep their faith in this technology that they've entrusted their bodies to.
I don't know if you feel this way, but it's interesting that the book came out. Well, the book came out a couple of months ago when Roe v. Wade wasn't really under quite as much imminent assault as it is today. But I don't know if you feel that this is sort of fortuitously timed. It feels so prescient as we're talking about women's reproductive rights and women's control over their own bodies and their own decisions. And the book just feels more urgent. And I haven't really been, I've read The Handmaid's Tale 100 years ago when it came out, but I haven't really been following the TV show. But all of these issues feel so much in the public eye right now, which I feel like is a very fortuitous time for your book to be addressing some of them. I assume kind of all this stuff was kind of swirling in your head, but is it taking on more of an urgency now that the book is out in the world and you're presumably having all these conversations about women's reproductive plight right now?
You know, the timing is sort of uncanny. And yes, I think that there is a heightened urgency about the topics addressed in the book. But, you know, I think really for women, they're ongoing, and there are certainly, you know, current events that spike specific new risks, you know, into the spotlight. But I think probably any time this book had been released, and it actually came out much later than I had hoped because it took so long to write and to publish. But I think on any given day, you know, there are really issues happening in the world that seem very pertinent to the themes in the book. So, you know, it's I wouldn't say a happy accident because I'm more, you know, things are very, very troubling in the world right now for women's reproduction and bodies, but just also in general. But yes, I think the conversations and the excitement surrounding the book have been kind of circumstantially intensified.
Yeah, yeah. So talk a little bit about the point of entry for you, kind of that, you know, what took you into it. It was the idea of it? Was it one of these characters? Or kind of talk about what the original inspiration was for you.
Oh, gosh. It's very basic. I was pregnant with my third child. And I have two other children who were also essentially babies at the time. I think they were 2 and 3. And I was working full time as a corporate recruiter. And just, you know, feeling sort of a dual sense of total overwhelm and exhaustion. And at the same time that I was also kind of doing it all, quote unquote, as weary as we all are of that phrase. That's become rather cliched. And so, you know, as I was miserably lying in bed with all day morning sickness, trying to pretend to work from home, these issues that were very viscerally affecting me kind of started to swirl. And, you know, in the immediate sense, I just wanted the pregnancy to be done with. So I just sort of started pushing that, you know, to further imagined scenarios that are, you know, absurd but not unfathomable.
Right, right. So let's talk a little bit about, for people who are writing novels set in the near future that have kind of a different rule set than modern, you know, than reality, but very, very similar, kind of establishing those sets of rules in your head and relaying them to the reader in a non-didactic way and kind of, you know, any of the challenges that you encountered and kind of how you keep those rules straight and, you know, world building. Does that make sense?
Yes, for sure. And this is probably the biggest challenge of writing a book set in the future or in an imagined world. A teacher of mine, Donald Antrim, once gave an entire lecture about the importance of world building as it pertains to winning the trust of the reader and, most importantly, giving them a sense of internal logic. Okay? So you can create as outrageous and far-fetched and removed from reality as of a world as you can conceive of. But within that world, there has to be a set of fixed rules and fixed logic so that the reader is freed up to stay within that world without questioning, well, you know, how could that be happening? Or, you know, that's inconsistent with something that happened previously. So I think it's really consistency and internal logic so that when a character makes a choice or a plot makes a turn, no matter how unexpected, it's still within the reader's, constructed, the sense that the author has constructed of plausibility. So it's really setting up those goalposts of plausibility and making sure that every choice you make with character and with plot falls within the logic you've created. And the whole point is to keep the reader suspended in a place of disbelief and trusting in the authority of the author.
Does that happen during the writing process, or is that something that you establish as writer before you set out to write it? Does that make sense? Like, does your office, is it filled with kind of all these post-it notes of like, okay, these are the rules of the world, and this is what I have to do to make them internally consistent, and then set out to write it? Or as you're writing, do you say, oh, shoot, here's another roadblock that I hadn't really considered that doesn't fit in with my internal logic?
For me, it's critical not to establish the rules of the world early and to just sort of forge ahead on the page, and let the ideas come. I think processes differ from author to author, of course, but for me to set the parameters too early on would inhibit by imagination, I think. And this might be a very inefficient way of writing, because when I come back for revision, I sometimes have to make some fairly fundamental changes. But, you know, for example, I did no research in the early drafts of this book. I didn't read about reprogenetics or CRISPR technology or anything that was happening with IVF. I just let the science and the lab settings be all over the place. And I had so much fun with it. And then later I came back and, you know, realized not only would a scientist be absolutely horrified by the book, but your average reader would find all sorts of holes and inconsistencies. So I had to go back. I had to read up on my science and then create this clinical setting that was completely removed from an actual clinical setting, but had enough internal logic and enough rules and enough sort of nods to actual scientific method that I hope most readers could buy it.
It may be inefficient, but I think that's really the best way to do it. Every writer that I talk to is like, if you outline in advance and you know what the outcome is before you've written it, it just falls flat. And I think even though it's painful to go through this, it's exactly the right answer. You know?
Well, I mean, I believe that even the most forward-thinking or structured novelist doesn't really know what their novel is until they've worked it out on the page. One of my favorite books about writing has a sort of mantra, and it's the book is the teacher. And I really believe that, you know, you sort of have to stay with the book, and it takes time and it takes draft after draft after draft before the story you want to tell and ultimately the meaning you're trying to coax out actually comes to the surface.
Right, right. One thing that I have to point out about this, if it hasn't come through yet, is this is infinitely unputdownable. I mean, you can't... it's very hard to turn out the light at 2 a.m.
Which is the best compliment you could possibly give
me. It's true. And so I want to talk a little bit about those techniques, because middles of books are difficult. And, you know, this was, like I say, it was so unputdownable. And so I'd love to talk a little bit about managing suspense and maintaining mm-hmm. reader interest in sort of the, you know, the classic doldrums of page 185 when, mm-hmm. you know, when it gets more difficult. I think some of that is the, you know, they're relatively short chapters, so that mm-hmm. makes you want to keep turning the page to see what happens next. And some of it may be the switching of point of view, but kind of give us your tips and tricks on managing suspense and maintaining such reader interest.
Well, I recommend having a really awesome editor, first and foremost, who can help you do it. But before that, I can actually offer, I love this question. This is such a writer's question. I mean, I have some specific craft techniques that are kind of my fallback solutions for preventing reader boredom. The first is to mix up dramatized scene and exposition. Hmm. I find it much easier to write thoughts and internal narratives and descriptions of place and all sorts of writerly prose that, you know, I have a background in poetry, and I just find it much easier to write the internal stuff, which is a very good formula for losing readers quickly. So dialogue, dramatized scene, just make sure, for me, if you really want to hold the reader's attention, make sure that you have, you know, a healthy interspersing of dramatized scene dialogue with that, you know, beautiful exposition. So mix those up, one. Two, I would say, and this is maybe less specific, but your job as an author is to create what a former teacher of mine, Julia Fierro, called the breadcrumb trail. And if you think of your reader as sort of following a trail of delicious breadcrumbs through the progression of your pages, and you don't want to keep them too hungry in between bites. So I come up, when I'm in a fairly advanced stage of revision, kind of those little breadcrumbs, those little turns of plot or little revelations, little rewards to the reader that have to come up every so often and leave them wanting a little bit more. So that, yes, I mean, the shorter sections, the rotating point of view is tricky, because as readers, we tend to favor a character and a voice. So sometimes a rotating point of view can leave a reader wanting to skim through some of the other points of view that aren't their favorites. So, you know, I would say if you are doing the multi-POV technique, make sure that as an author, you love each of your characters. Each of your characters is totally indispensable and critical to you, and you're fully invested in them and their arc and their plight. Because if you're bored as the author, you will absolutely transmit that to your reader.
Such good advice. So let's talk about some of these points of view and some of these characters and how you mined them and how you got to know them. And maybe who gave you the most difficulty in working with. Just talk a little bit about that, of who, kind
sure.
of how you got to know these guys.
Sure. So Tessa was by far my biggest challenge. You know, woman in her early 40s, like myself, works in the tech sector, like myself, has conflict about domestic life, you know, like me. And it's a common challenge to write a character who's closest to yourself, because it requires, you know, to make a character interesting, you have to expose them. You have to reveal their vulnerabilities. You have to get to the stuff that's happening under their surface. And if that character is like you, it can be really uncomfortable to dig and get to that dark, complex, gray area. So Tessa was very hard for me. It took many years and many drafts and all sorts of ridiculous tricks. You know, at a certain point, I killed off her husband, Peter, which does not happen in the book. It's not a spoiler. and just to sort of make her vulnerable, to make her feel something. And that felt overly calculated. And in the end, I think it was staying with her and kind of just sitting back and trying not to force emotion and force vulnerability, just sort of letting her talk. You know, I did some of the classic techniques, journaling from her point of view. I wrote a speech from her point of view that a large portion of which actually made it into the book. And when she and I sort of cleaved from each other and she became her own intact entity, that's when I kind of finally got to, you know, made her interesting. Mm-hmm. Some of the other characters like Wayne, you know, I sort of had a crush on as I started to write him. And so he was much easier.
Didn't we all?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And of course, the farthest removed from me, you know, sort of military government agent, spy-like man. I don't know any men like that. I didn't know anything about him, and getting to know him was really sort of a joy.
It is interesting how many writers say that the more different the character, the easier they are to access. And, you know, I don't know if you had... if that's true of writing men. I was just talking in the first half hour to Gabe, who said writing women was really difficult for him. But if the men, you know, if you were able to come to them a little bit easier because they were different, or if they were more challenging because they were different.
I think easier because they are different. And there is almost an implicit permission to not be loyal to any, I don't know, any particular traits. I mean, men are a mystery to me. You know, I'm married to one. I have a son. But in many regards, their inner workings are mysterious. And in a way, that frees me up to make up reasons, make up motivations, invent psychology. But with women, it's almost like I know a little too much. It kind of goes back to right. Why I don't research before I start writing. If it's too, you know, if there's too much there to guide me, it inhibits my imagination.
Yeah, right. God, it's killing me. We're running out of time, and I have so much else to talk about.
Okay.
Is there advice that you would give out that has kind of things that have sustained you over the so you've written two books, and they're very different from each other. Are there things that, you know, you would point out to writers either getting started or even established writers that's kind of helped you out over the years of doing this?
You know, I'm not sure if I have, original advice to offer, but
it's hard to have original advice at this point.
Yeah, viewing, right. I mean, really approaching writing as a daily practice. And, you know, to not sit down under the enormous and nebulous sort of weight of writing a novel, because it is so hard and it takes so long. And if you let yourself sort of view it in with too much of a macro scope from the get-go, you'll be bogged down and for me, paralyzed. So really, if I think, okay, I'm going to write from 5:30 to 7 every day this week, and that's it. That's all I'm going to require of myself. You know, I'm not sure if it's going to be good. I'm not sure if it's going to be garbage, but I'm going to write for 90 minutes every morning, let's say. I find that if you stay faithful to your practice day after day, month after month, eventually year after year, a novel or, you know, whatever your end goal is will organically emerge. And that's not to say that you then don't have to get very strategic, but that comes later. Think big later.
Yeah, and with three kids and a full-time job, I don't know how else he would do it. I mean, there's just, you know, you would have to carve out that time, and you wouldn't have a choice, or it wouldn't get done. So,
exactly. But you know, I'm a big believer in this idea of role buffering. Sort of the less time you have, the more you get done. In your allotments.
So true. Chailey Wolfson Widger, this was such a pleasure. Congratulations. This is wonderful. Wonderful.
Thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation with some of the best questions I've heard in a long time.
Oh, thank you. Mother of Invention is the book. It is out and available now. It is it's a can't put downable read, so I highly recommend it. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day, and stay tuned for more great programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.